This manuscript, The Politics of Civilizational Healing, investigates why harmful societal systems persist despite clear evidence of their damage and explores the structural capacities required to achieve legitimate, durable transformation. Okay, so what I really like about this part is the sheer depth of the analytical frameworks provided.
Yeah, it's incredibly dense, in a good way.
Right, especially things like the enactment circuit and the three-axis power audit. It takes this incredibly strong, academically rigorous, and highly systemic approach to diagnosing societal inertia.
It really does. I mean, they don't just settle for the usual talking points about, you know, a lack of political will.
No, not at all.
Or pointing fingers at some sort of cartoon villain conspiracy. Instead, they dig really deep into the mechanics of incumbency. They acknowledge that we often have the epistemic capacity, meaning, you know, we know a system is harmful, but we fundamentally lack the transformational capacity to actually dismantle it.
Exactly. The way the material treats a regime as the stabilized configuration of institutions, rules, and resource flows, it's just a highly mature analytical lens.
Yeah, a very clear-eyed look at structural lock-in.
For sure. And the text brilliantly separates the threshold of legitimate authorization from the threshold of operationalization. Like, winning a legislative mandate is completely different from actually having the administrative or technical capacity to build the successor system.
Right. You can pass all the laws you want, but if you don't have the tools to build the new road, you're just stuck on the old one.
That is exactly it. So I can see what they're going for here, but let's see how we can strengthen this. Because while the theoretical architecture in the first half is an absolute masterclass in political economy, something shifts when we cross over into the empirical application.
Yeah, I noticed that too.
Let's look closely at the section discussing the comparative transformational episodes. It feels a bit like spending 10 chapters learning the intricate mechanics of a new camera. But when we finally go out to shoot the 5 case studies, we just leave it in auto mode.
Oh, that's such a great analogy. That's clearly laid out. I wonder, though, if we've considered how heavily the reader actually relies on those frameworks to make sense of the history.
It's a huge reliance, right?
Yeah. They just the transition between the theoretical framework in the first 10 sections and the empirical case studies in section 11 feels disjointed.
Disjointed is the perfect word for it. That's precisely what tripped me up.
Right, because the weakness here is that the manuscript spends immense effort constructing specific models like the power persistence transformation matrix, but these precise visual tools and their direct terminologies largely fade into the background during the case study analysis.
They really do. They just sort of vanish.
Exactly. Making it incredibly difficult for the reader to see exactly how the theories operate in practice once the historical narrative actually kicks in.
Yeah, I see this happen a lot in prod systemic research. We spend pages establishing these incredible concepts, you know, regime reproduction capacity, countervailing capacity, all the vital differences between drift, entrenchment, and contested transformation.
All the heavy terminology.
Right. But then we get to the case studies on tobacco control, the Montreal Protocol, fossil energy, and urban sanitation. And those specific labels are just, they're absent.
It reads almost like a standard historical overview. We lose the rigorous application of the author's own proprietary matrices.
I imagine there's a temptation for the author to just, well, let the history flow. You don't want the narrative to feel too clunky or weighed down by jargon.
Sure. You definitely want it to be readable. But there is a middle ground here. If the author built a custom diagnostic machine in the first 10 sections, the reader genuinely wants to see the patient put through that specific machine, complete with all the machine's readouts.
Yeah, the theoretical vocabulary has to do the heavy lifting in the empirical sections.
Otherwise, what was the point of learning all that vocabulary in the first place?
Exactly my thought. So, our suggestion here is to explicitly integrate the terminology and matrices from the first half into the structure of the case study analysis in the second half.
Right. Don't hide the framework. Let it actively drive the narrative.
Let's think about how that actually looks on the page, though. Like, how do we bring that auto mode camera back into manual?
Well, think about the tobacco case. A concrete way to fix this would be to explicitly plot its trajectory on the power persistence matrix.
Oh, that would be cool.
Right? Imagine opening that section with the actual visual matrix showing its move from entrenchment to contested transformation. We could literally read about how high regime reproduction capacity, like the tobacco lobby's golden era, met growing transformational capacity from public health advocates.
And actually see it moving across the quadrants in real time.
Yes, exactly. It would be incredibly satisfying to read.
Another great example would be the Montreal Protocol. Instead of just recounting the diplomatic history, the author could directly apply the three-axis power audit to show exactly which actors held generative and institutional power.
Break down the multilateral fund right there on the axis of modality, direction, and legitimacy.
Right. Make it clear that these are just a few out of all possible ways to weave the framework directly into the historical examples. The author could use pull quotes, sidebars, or even just heavily lean on the italicized terminology within the paragraphs themselves.
The goal is simply to make the theory an active lens. But, you know, playing devil's advocate for a second, could the evidence also support a different conclusion? Like, perhaps the case studies are meant to be read as standalone narratives for a broader audience who might get bogged down by the matrices.
I hear that, but honestly, I don't think it holds up for this specific audience. I mean, if someone has made it through 10 sections of dense political economy, they aren't going to get scared off by a matrix in section 11.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
If anything, anchoring the history in the established vocabulary only deepens their impact. It proves the sheer utility of the models.
And utility really is the ultimate test for a manuscript focused on civilizational healing. If you can't use the tools, the healing doesn't happen.
Which leads perfectly into my next thought. If we are asking readers to actively apply these tools to their own case studies, they need to know precisely how to operate them on the ground. As I understand it from the notes, the argument here is that power must be audited across modality, direction, and legitimacy.
Right, the three-axis power audit.
Exactly. But I have to ask, how does an independent researcher actually do that without a massive budget? Like, if I am a local organizer trying to dismantle a harmful municipal policy, I understand the theory of the audit, but I have no idea where to even start looking for the data.
Is the connection between A and B fully established in the material? Or is that an area to potentially bolster? Because the topic sentence here is that the three-axis power audit is conceptually brilliant, but currently lacks practical implementation steps for the researcher or policymaker.
Yes, that is exactly the friction I felt.
The weakness is that the material introduces a really robust theoretical structure for auditing power, but it does not offer a clear methodology for how a scholar or civic leader is supposed to gather and weigh the empirical data required to actually perform this audit in the real world.
It's a bit like handing someone a highly advanced diagnostic manual for a rare disease, but not giving them a stethoscope.
Or even telling them which lab tests to order. Yeah. The axes are beautifully defined in the abstract. Axis A looks at modality. Is the power material, institutional, epistemic, or discursive?
Right.
Axis B looks at direction. Is it reinforcive, innovative, or transformational? And Axis C evaluates legitimacy. But when you step outside the theoretical vacuum, I mean, how does one actually measure discursive power in a bounded, local, transformational episode?
Exactly. How do I quantify structural dependence when I'm looking at a single fossil fuel plant in my hometown? The theoretical what is there, but the operational how is totally missing.
So what's the fix here?
The suggestion is to provide a brief, actionable methodology or a step-by-step heuristic for conducting the power audit within a bounded transformational episode.
But wait, let me push back slightly on that. One might argue that qualitative research methodologies are already incredibly well established in the social sciences. Does the author really need to write a methods textbook in the middle of a political theory manuscript? Researchers generally know how to do research.
That's true, but the three-axis power audit is highly unique to this specific manuscript. Because it synthesizes multiple distinct literatures, you know, historical institutionalism, political economy, transitions research, it requires a unique methodological key.
Ah, I see what you mean.
You can't just plug this audit into a standard statistical regression. It requires a very specific kind of qualitative and quantitative mapping. Giving the reader that map isn't over-explaining. It's essential for the tool to function.
That makes total sense. We need to bridge the gap between high theory and grounded research.
If the core goal of the civilizational healing program is to equip distributed actors with the capacity to alter causal structures, then the tools themselves absolutely must be accessible.
So let's brainstorm some concrete examples of what that methodology could look like without turning the book into a textbook. The author could add a short how-to paragraph detailing where to look for evidence of institutional power.
Like analyzing lobbying records, maybe?
Exactly. Analyzing lobbying records, mapping out corporate board compositions, or tracing PAC funding streams.
I love that. Another option is to create a sample worksheet or a set of probing questions in Appendix A that directly correspond to the three axes, allowing users to map out actors systematically.
Oh, a worksheet would be amazing.
Right? For instance, under epistemic power, the worksheet could prompt the user to list sponsored university research or closed-source algorithmic models.
That would be incredibly valuable. And we should point out that these are just a couple of potential solutions to give the audience a concrete starting point. Whether it's a paragraph in the main text or a worksheet in the back, the goal is simply to translate the what of the audit into the how of the real world.
And speaking of the real world, mapping those power dynamics is incredibly urgent right now, especially when we look at the prospective case study at the end of the manuscript on artificial intelligence.
Oh, yes, that's a huge pivot.
It is. The jump from historical cases like 19th century urban sanitation to the current frontier of AI is a massive leap, but it's a necessary one to prove the framework works for the future, not just the past.
It really is an ambitious leap. The material makes a strong case for governing AI as an epistemic commons by highlighting the need to avoid machine sovereignty.
Right, looking at the rapid concentration of compute, data, and talent.
Yeah, but I have to admit, reading through this final section, I found myself wrestling with the framing of it. Is there a risk that we are treating AI as a future governance problem rather than a present-day infrastructure of lock-in?
Building on that point, what if we looked at it from the perspective of the specific regime reproduction mechanisms listed earlier in the text?
Exactly where my head was at.
The bold stance on artificial intelligence as a tool for epistemic augmentation risks overshadowing its immediate relevance to the core concept of regime reproduction capacity.
That hits on a huge missed opportunity in the text. The weakness is that while the manuscript rightly warns about AI's potential for political substitution, it somewhat isolates the AI discussion from the highly detailed mechanisms of regime reproduction outlined way back in Section 3.
It really does. You can feel this isolation in the way the AI section is written. The tone completely shifts.
Yeah, causing the reader to miss how AI is actively functioning right now as an entrenchment multiplier for incumbent tech regimes.
Right, because it focuses heavily on the future, on prospective tests, on preventing AI from acquiring sovereign authority to define collective ends, on ensuring it acts as an epistemic commons. Now, don't get me wrong. These are brilliant, vital philosophical boundaries. We need to be having those conversations.
Oh, absolutely. But they feel disconnected from the gritty reality of the rest of the book.
Exactly. Because back in Section 3, in Table 1, the author gave us an absolute master key for how harmful regimes persist today.
Right. Table 1.
They listed mechanisms like path dependence, material and infrastructural dependence, and epistemic control. By treating AI primarily as a novel, emerging entity that needs future constitutional safeguards, we completely miss the opportunity to diagnose it using the very tools the paper just established.
It's like having a printing press that only prints incumbent propaganda and worrying endlessly about what it might print tomorrow, instead of analyzing the fact that it currently holds a vicious monopoly on the town's paper supply today.
That is a perfect analogy.
The future threat is real, but the present-day monopoly is actively hurting us.
So the suggestion here is to directly tie the AI analysis back to the specific mechanisms of regime reproduction listed in Table 1, such as path dependence and epistemic control.
Make AI subject to the exact same rigorous, gritty analysis as fossil fuels or tobacco. Doing that would make the entire manuscript feel unbelievably cohesive.
It really would. It would prove that the framework developed in the first half isn't just useful for looking backward at the Montreal Protocol, it is the exact tool we need to dissect the most complex technological rollout in human history as it happens. Let's give some concrete examples of how to ground this AI chapter using Table 1.
The author could explicitly reframe the current concentration of AI compute, you know, the fact that only a few companies have the hardware to train frontier models, as a classic example of material and infrastructural dependence.
Link it directly back to Section 3 to show how bottleneck facilities enforce regime lock-in.
Yes.
Because the hardware isn't a future problem, it's a current infrastructural choke point.
Or they could show how proprietary AI models exemplify epistemic control.
Right, actively preventing challengers from accessing the data needed to build countervailing capacity.
Exactly. By keeping the training data and weights hidden, these companies are actively preventing that countervailing capacity from forming. By explicitly using the vocabulary from Table 1, the author demonstrates that AI is already exhibiting the symptoms of an entrenched regime.
And we want to point out that these are just a few ways to firmly anchor the AI discussion in the paper's overarching theory of civilizational lock-in. There are many other mechanisms from that early table, like discursive normalization or co-option, that apply flawlessly to the current AI landscape.
Oh, we see discursive normalization every single day when tech CEOs talk about AI inevitability.
Right, like it's just this natural force of physics we have to accept. Tying it back really elevates the stakes of the whole manuscript. When you link AI back to the core mechanisms of regime reproduction, you realize that the challenge isn't just about writing good regulations for a new software tool.
No, not at all.
It's about confronting a massive concentration of structural power that is actively building high regime reproduction capacity. It illustrates the author's central thesis perfectly. Knowing the harm of a system isn't enough if you lack the transformational capacity to disrupt its dependencies.
And this brings us right back to the enactment circuit the author established early on. The premise is that AI enters this program under a strict principle, epistemic augmentation, without political substitution. But to actually achieve that, we have to map the power of AI precisely as we would for a fossil energy incumbent.
We really do.
We have to identify which parts of the AI stack require legitimate constraint, perhaps the opaque, proprietary foundation models, and which parts represent convertible capabilities, like the underlying mathematical engineering or hardware infrastructure that could be repurposed for a public epistemic commons.
It's a beautifully recursive argument if it's threaded properly.
It really is. The AI can theoretically augment every phase of that enactment circuit, from perceiving societal injury signals to modeling policy portfolios. But if the underlying infrastructure is monopolized, using the exact mechanisms from Table 1, it corrupts the very reflexivity the civilization needs to heal.
Wow.
The argument is all there. It just needs that explicit structural tethering to the earlier chapters to truly land with maximum force.
So a key theme running through this material seems to be structural integration. The theoretical models provided in the first half are exceptional. The historical case studies are rich, and the future outlook on AI is profound. But to maximize the impact of the work, the author should bring the theoretical matrices directly into the text of the case studies, make the power audit practically actionable for researchers, and explicitly connect the prospective AI analysis to the early definitions of regime reproduction.
This manuscript is tackling one of the most profound and necessary questions of our time: how we actually move from diagnosing societal injury to enacting durable, legitimate healing. The ambition of this research is staggering, and the analytical vocabulary it provides is exactly what movements, policymakers, and scholars need right now. The foundation is incredibly solid. It just needs its internal connections tightened.
I couldn't agree more. The potential here is massive. We would love to see how these elements evolve, so we warmly invite the listener to submit their revised work back in again for more feedback in a future critique. In the end, we all want to fix the collapsing building. And getting these tools sharpened is the first step. Thanks for joining us.